kinds of chairs.
Judge Bishop of the Court of Appeals will be participating. You may proceed.
Honors, may it please the court, my name is Danny Levitt from the office of Terrence Jason Lerno on behalf of the colonies, Shamika Holloway. Your Honors, this case principally arises under the State Tort Claims Act, which embodies the legislature's waiver of governmental immunity and consent to suit for tortious acts of governmental employees. I would like to principally focus, if I may, at least on two issues before the court. The first is regarding the applicability of the district court's finding with respect to the discretionary function exception of the State Tort Claims Act. And the second, assuming that that exception is applicable, whether the plaintiff still stated a claim for the complaint. Regarding the first issue is with respect to the exception of the discretionary function. That exception is found in 81.8219 of the State Tort Claims Act. And that was designed by the legislature of this state only to protect decision-making grounded in social, economic, and political policy. Any proposition contrary to that is simply in line with this court's precedents. As reflected in Berkovitz versus the United States and Jaza against Douglas County, there's a two-step process in determining whether the discretionary function exception applies. That is, first, to determine whether the challenged conduct has anything to do with the choice. That's simply by the definition of the word discretionary. The second is, assuming that the challenged conduct does involve choice, is it one in which the legislature envisioned to be shielded from liability? These two steps help us determine and clearly reveal the whole rationale of the discretionary function exception, which is separation of powers. The court on the one hand, executives or administrators. The court has held that discretionary function exception of the State Tort Claims Act is inapplicable when a statute, regulation, or policy is specifically prescribes governmental conduct or action. I think it's important that this court wrestle up front with Mental Health Commitment Act, Section 71920, because with all due respect, my friends on the other side put a lot of weight and emphasis on Section 921 of the Mental Health Commitment Act. But that section actually states that any person who believes that another person is mentally may communicate such belief to an attorney. In other words, myself, any citizen of the state may report a mental illness dangerousness if they so please, but are not required to. On the other hand, Section 71.921 of the Mental Health Commitment Act specifically states that a mental health professional who, upon evaluation, shall execute a written certificate, that certificate shall be immediately forwarded to the county attorney.
Aren't you leaving out a fairly critical phrase, though, in that sentence, a mental health professional who, upon evaluation of a person admitted for emergency protective custody under 71919, which is there is a procedure that has to happen first, right?
Correct, Judge Bishop. And with respect, I would suggest that Section 71919 states that emergency protective custody includes somebody already in custody. Mr. Jenkins clearly was in custody. So I think that that fits up squarely with Section 71920 because he was in custody. And so mental health professionals are dealing with him down at the department. There's reports being made. They're in the know on the mental illness and dangerousness. And they simply failed to adhere to the prescribed actions set forth in 71920 to transfer that information to the county attorney proceed with mental health civil commitment. So I would suggest reading Section 71919 as a continuation of somebody already in custody. I think we set that out in our brief as well.
The federal district court has considered this issue, hasn't it?
That case is on appeal in the Eighth Circuit, currently pending appeal.
Okay, so the federal district court's ruling was adverse to your position, but there's an appeal pending.
That's correct, Your Honor. It's identical to, similarly situated to the court's ruling in this case.
Thank you.
And I think it's important to note, again, up front, that we wrestle with this language of shall. And I recognize and concede that there are occasions when a statute can use mandatory language or ministerial language such as shall, yet also be interpreted as directory. And that is when the statute in question is not in line with the overall spirit and purpose of the act. And that is noted in this court's case, Ivey versus Gibson, just handed down last August, wherein, Justice Connolly, you noted that the Sex Offender Commitment Act only used, there was a provision in question that used the word shall, but the overall spirit and purpose of that act was to protect the public. My friends on the other side went a long way to concede in that case that that was the overall purpose of the Sex Offender Commitment Act. That purpose of that act is nearly identical to the overall purpose and spirit of the Mental Health Commitment Act, which is simply to have the effectiveness and the viability of these mentally ill and dangerous folks to be treated, essentially to protect the public. And so I think either way you cut it, either reading the statute expressly with the language shall, these folks were engaged in a ministerial function, not a discretionary function. Or, this court so desires to look at that language and review the overall purpose of the Mental Health Commitment Act. This was something that was designed, already decided by the legislature, to be prescribed, ministerial, not discretionary. We think also that the court gets it right in the Lemke case, and there's a strong similarity from that case to the facts of this case. In Lemke, there was a defective connector that Metropolitan Utilities District had provided to its customers and the public, and they were in possession by the AGA, the American Gas Association, of these connectors being defective. The proposition laid out in that case, the court stated, was that when a governmental entity is in possession, has actual or constructive notice of a dangerous condition or hazard, and that knowledge is not the public or those that are unknown to that that information, not privy to that information. The government is acting in a non-discretionary function or way by not disclosing that information to those that are likely injured by that information. And that fits up squarely here. Mr. Wheelidge, I think the record here is fairly extensive. Legislative hearing record that we provided in this case demonstrates that Mr. Jenkins was very mentally ill, very dangerous to the public, and that the department was in possession of this information. When incarcerated in solitary confinement, was engaging in acts that were totally and clearly manifesting themselves as a mental illness, and yet they deliberately withheld that information in violation of 71-920 of the Mental Health Commitment Act, produced that information to the county attorney. Because they did that, we would argue that this case is right in line with the Lemke case, and that they were engaged in a ministerial function, not a discretionary function, contrary to what the district court held.
How do you use the word withheld?
Well, I think
or failed to come forward, is that withheld?
Either way, I think if you fail to come forward, I think the statute incorporates that type of information, that they're required to execute a written certificate to the county attorney. By not doing that, that is withholding it. An omission can be withholding it. And when they're in that...
Is that how you would describe it? It was an omission?
Well, I think the complaint, on the face of the complaint, it envisions deliberate actions as well as omission. That's all we're required to do at the pleading stage. In this
because
case,
this went out on the complaint.
I'm sorry, what was
this it? This was dismissed on the complaint.
That's correct, Your Honor. And under the liberal notice pleading standards, we're not required to plead out specifically all the details of what's going on down there at the department. just by simply getting above the speculative level and stating a plausible claim for relief is all that the plaintiff is required to do.
Counsel, is it your position that the Department of Correctional Services has an absolute duty under 71-920 to file the certificate or to notify the county attorney of every mentally ill and dangerous person in the custody of the department?
Justice Stacey, I think the legislature has already made that determination. When they are in possession of a mentally ill person determined by medical doctors.
So that's a yes?
That's a yes. I think when the information is provided by medical doctors, it's their determination, and that information is stating that this inmate is mentally ill and dangerous, the legislature has already made the determination that that certificate needs to be forwarded to the county attorney. So, in line with what I started out saying in terms of the whole purpose of the discretionary function exception, the idea of separation of powers where the courts aren't having to make policy decisions that the legislature is normally set out to do, they have already done that by the use of 71-919.
How do your pleadings reflect that the process described in 71-919 was met?
Well, I think paragraphs 23 and 24 of the complaint simply state that Jenkins was in custody with the department at the time that this vital information was to be forwarded to the county attorney.
And then, so you would concede that this was not an emergency protective custody. It's another form of state custody.
Well, I would respectfully disagree, Justice Castle, because Section 71-919, as I described earlier, envisions emergency protective custody as a continuation of custody.
Where does it say that? Where does it say that in 919?
I believe... after subsection 1, or continue his or her custody if he or she is already in custody.
Well, that's just an option of admitting them into a medical facility, or they can maintain custody where they are. But that doesn't turn being in custody into emergency protective custody, does it?
Well, with respect, I mean, they used emergency protective custody earlier in the statute, and that provision, that phrase... it only stated custody as opposed to emergency protective custody. So I think the omission of emergency protective custody and the use of the word custody envisions somebody like Mr. Jenkins already in custody. I think that goes in line, again, with the overall purpose of the Mental Health Commitment Act, which is simply to protect the public and to forward that vital information to the county attorney at that appropriate time. And if I may just address really briefly the other issue which I started out with, assuming that the discretionary function exception does not apply to the facts of this case, we would suggest also that the plaintiff's complaint still states a claim for relief in that a duty still exists because a special relationship was had. Again, Mr. Jenkins was in the custody of the department, and that was when the breach occurred, was when that vital information was not transferred. He was let out. And anything beyond that has to do with foreseeability or determining the breach, which is determined later on by the fact finder of the case.
The special relationship between who and who?
Well, I would refer this court to Section 315 of the restatement as laid out in the Bartunek case, which is the third party whom the defendant has control over. So whomever that... defendant has control over is where the special relationship lies.
Restatement third.
So it's between the department and Jenkins?
That's correct, Your Honor.
That's the relationship. That's what I want to be clear what your argument is.
That's correct, yes. Yes, Your Honor, that there was a special relationship. Anything beyond that is reserved for the prior fact. If I may reserve my time.
May it please the Court, David Lopez, Assistant Attorney General, representing the state appellees in this matter, along with co-counsel Ryan Post. As a threshold matter, because the state cannot be held...
Excuse me, counsel, have you allocated time here?
I'm sorry, Your
Honor. Allocated time between the...
We have. We will divide the appellee's argument, 8 minutes for the state appellees and 7 minutes for Mr. Papik for CCS.
You.
Regarding the state appellee's arguments in favor of affirmance, because the state government cannot be held financially or legally liable for the private acts of violence that take place between members of the general public, neither of whom bearing a special relation to the state, and because of the operation of the discretionary function exception in this case, the district court's decision should be affirmed in its entirety. On the sole theory that Ms. Holloway pursues on appeal, she alleges that that the state was negligent in failing to pursue civil commitment proceedings for Mr. Nico Jenkins prior to his release from prison. Putting aside the fact that even under a theory that the state should have initiated civil commitment proceedings, there would be no guarantee as a result from a results standpoint that Mr. Jenkins would have been subject to a civil commitment. The fact of the matter is that pleads on its face a discretionary act for state officials. Under the provision of law that Ms. Holloway has pled, which is Section 920, it's inapplicable given the emergency protective custody issue that was addressed during Mr. Levitt's argument. Because Mr. Jenkins was not pled to have been in emergency protective custody, 71-919 cannot apply to his case. I would note that there is a separate statutory construct within Nebraska law that applies to facilitate the taking of an inmate into initiating civil commitment proceedings of an inmate following their mandatory discharge date. And I apologize to the court because it wasn't something that's part of the record. I don't have the citation off the top of my head. But even in that circumstance, which was not pled by Ms. Holloway here, even under that statutory construct, she would have needed to plead that two state-designated psychiatrists filled out a similar certificate sufficient to initiate commitment proceedings for Mr. Jenkins following his mandatory discharge.
Is that the statute?
Requirement? I beg your pardon.
Is that the statute? You're talking about the statute dealing with sex offenders?
No, this is a separate. It's in a separate statutory chapter under the corrections chapter.
Okay.
It's not this one, which does deal with sex offenders, and is another problem with 71-919's applicability to Mr. Jenkins' case because he certainly has not been pled to have been a sex offender.
But is that a pleading requirement? That one would have to plead the existence of two psychiatric reports?
I think he would need to plead that.
Or would there have to be a pleading perhaps referring to an applicable or a controlling statute?
If he wanted to prevail, in order to prevail on her theory that the state was subject to a mandatory legal duty to pursue civil commitment proceedings of Mr. Jenkins before he was released, Ms. Holloway needs to identify some provision or principle of state law that creates that duty. And there is nowhere in statute or at the common law that creates such a duty. So I think certainly in this case that does create a pleading defect over which he can't get past. Particularly when you look at then, and this was the statute that we identified as the nearest provision to 71-920 that could have possibly been a provision under which Mr. Jenkins could have been civilly committed, and that's 71-921. That says may, and that's what the district court relied upon in finding that the discretionary function exception applies. Regarding my friend Mr. Levitt's references to the Lemke decision, I think that case is wholly inapplicable here. In that case, the Metropolitan Utilities District had a gas system in a discrete geographic area that was under their control, and given their control over it, they had a duty to warn the people within the area that could be affected of the potential for harm. Here, Mr. Jenkins was absolutely not under the control or in any kind of legal relationship to the state at the time of the alleged crime, given that he had been mandatorily discharged. He was not on parole. He was not among any of the early release individuals that have dealt with, that have previously been issues with the Department of Correctional Services. He was completely out of our control. So even if you get past that piece of it, in Lemke, there was a discrete geographic area in which MUD might have had a duty to warn. It's difficult to discern what group of the population should have been warned by the department before Mr. Jenkins was released on his mandatory discharge date. All of this aside on the discretionary function exception, and even if this court rejects that argument in its entirety, we still prevail on the special relationship doctrine as articulated in Bartunek. Since neither Jenkins nor Holloway were in a special relationship with the state at the time of the alleged shooting, a shooting I would add that, unlike Mr. Jenkins' murders, is not a crime for which he's been prosecuted by the county attorney's office. There cannot be state liability for such a private act of violence. Under Mr. Levitt's proposed construct, the state would become liable for an entirely new set of private crimes by inmates following their release from our custody. And it's simply not a path I think the court wants to explore in terms of that kind of new branching out of liability. I would conclude with just a couple of points based on Mr. Levitt's argument regarding the special committee proceedings. That is not in evidence. That was not something that was pled. His references to it and the contents of those reports are not entitled to any presumption of truth, though his pleadings are. And regarding his the claim argued in their brief that additional discovery could have repaired the central legal defects in his case, because it's impossible to discern how Ms. Holloway could have possibly been pled to have been in a special relationship with the state, or that Mr. Jenkins was not out of custody at any level, Bartunek remains an insuperable bar to Ms. Holloway's claims. For those reasons, and unless the court has any additional questions, we would ask that you affirm the district court's dismissal in its entirety. Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Jonathan Papik. I'm here today on behalf of the Appellee Correct Care Solutions, LLC. Correct Care is a private corporation that provides medical services in a number of correctional institutions in Nebraska and the country. Most of the argument that you've heard this morning on this case has focused on the applicability of the discretionary function exception. That is not an issue with respect to CCS. As a contractor, they don't have the protections of the State Tort Claims Act. Nonetheless, the district court set forth three independent grounds for dismissal of CCS in this case, each of which I would argue would support affirmance here today. I'd like to start by talking about the special relationship argument that counsel for both appellant and Mr. Lopez have mentioned. With respect to CCS, the absence of a special relationship is even more clear, because not only was Mr. Jenkins not in state custody at the time that the alleged shooting took place, there's no allegation that he was ever in the custody of CCS. Plaintiff's complaint, and here today you've heard him argue, that the argument is Mr. Jenkins was in the custody of the state, not a mere contract medical provider. And so with no custodial relationship, Bartunek would preclude any possibility of liability on CCS. Secondly, the district court recognized that this is not a case in which liability can be imposed on a mental health professional. This court recognized in the Munsterman case that by statute, Nebraska has limited the circumstances under which mental health providers can be held liable for the violent acts of their patients. And those circumstances, the limited circumstance, is when the patient communicates a threat to the mental health provider directed toward a reasonably identifiable victim.
In this case, there's no allegation that Ms. Holloway was a reasonably identifiable victim of any threat that Mr. Jenkins may have made. And in fact, the complaint alleged just the opposite by alleging that Mr. Jenkins' threats were to kill people at random. And in the absence of an allegation that Ms. Holloway was a readily identifiable victim, liability can't be imposed under the Moonstrom case. Finally, I would add that the district court also held, and I would argue that this would support affirmance as well, that the complaint just does not set forth a basis for any claims against CCS. CCS is mentioned very infrequently in the complaint, and to the extent it is mentioned, it is mentioned in the context of a CCS psychiatrist, Dr. Natalie Baker. Dr. Baker at one time was a named defendant in this case, but in the transcript you'll see that at some point appellants filed a motion to voluntarily dismiss her, which they go explain at some length that they have concluded that Dr. Baker did everything that was required of her and any damages that Ms. Holloway may have suffered were not her fault. Having conceded that Dr. Baker did everything she was supposed to do, there's just nothing in the complaint that would set forth what it is CCS, what duty they had, or how they breached it, or how that contributed to any damages.
The allegations as to CCS are essentially through Dr. Baker?
I would argue that if you read the complaint, that is the only reference you'll see to CCS. With any factual allegations you'll see as to CCS pertains to Dr. Baker, and then those are essentially pulled back in the notice of voluntary. If there are no other questions for the court, I would ask that you affirm the dismissal of CCS.
Thank you. Any rebuttal time?
We have a minute and 11.
Your Honors, I'd like to pick up just briefly on your question, Justice Mueller-Lehrman, about the pleading requirements, that indeed it is not required by the plaintiff to allege those specific facts and details of what occurred. Simply putting them on notice is what the requirement is. Some provisions, I guess, of the regulations, statutes were discussed as well. I think the determination here is whether there is a provision of regulation or policy, some sort of procedure, which is certainly borne out in the complaint, whether those exist. And a determination of whether those are discretionary is the real question. And we haven't been able to engage in any discovery whatsoever up to this point to determine even whether there were a violation of any regulations or policies that occurred. With respect to the distinguishment of the Lemke case, discussing a geographic area, I think he was in the central control of the state, identical to that case. Regarding... Just briefly, I see I'm out of time.
You are now. Thank you.
Thank you.
We are adjourned.